I met Studs Terkel, who just told me we'd never met. When he interviewed me after publication of my first novel in 1970. I was living in Mississippi, and I had grown up in Georgia, and I was writing about the system of slave continuance called sharecropping, and what it did and what it does to human beings still in the world. And what I loved about Studs was that he had actually read the book. He knew what it was about, and he saw me and he heard me. He listened. Howard and I met at an honors dinner at Spelman College when I was a student in the early 60s. And he has claimed that I was very quiet that night, and I never told him why. And I shall tell him why tonight. He was probably the first white man I had ever sat next to. And he was definitely the first white man that I had ever in my life seen actually listening to black people speak. I was stunned. That's why I was quiet. As soon as I could manage it, I became his student for a whole semester. And this person has been one of the enduring inspirations of my life. These two great human beings, Studs Terkel and Howard Zinn, teach us the beauty of endurance, of being teachers and activists, of seeing them as the same thing. They teach us the joy of illustrating the alternative, which both of them have done their entire long lives. But as I thought about my welcoming of them to our beloved Berkeley, one quality that they share stayed in my mind. They are both listeners. Between them, they seem to have listened to and heard almost everyone in this century. Howard has even listened to the voices of Native Americans whose words were recorded by those who came to the New World with Christopher Columbus in 1492. Listening, they have broken chain after chain of silence. Speaking and helping others to speak, they have changed the world by changing lives. They do not then have to say of themselves, as many men must say of themselves, and as Neruda wrote, "It so happens I am sick of being a man. I don't want to go on being a root in the dark, insecure, stretched out, shivering with sleep, going on down into the moist guts of the earth, talking, taking in and thinking, eating every day. I don't want so much misery. I don't want to go on as a root and a tomb, alone under the ground, a warehouse with corpses." No, Howard and Studs can say instead, as I say in this poem that I wrote for them today, "I have been a standing self in this world. I have braved both pleasure and disgust. I have lived my words. The stranger appeared, and I did not look away. The crazy youth wandered by, and I sometimes followed him. The virgin cried, and I investigated her tears. I am a man, a person, an elder, shining and wise. I am someone who happily discovered the use of my ears. I am someone who happily discovered the use of my mind. I am someone who happily discovered the use of my heart. I meet the young people, the soldiers, the prisoners, the students, the poor people, the people of color, the Indians, and the women of the planet, and I am not afraid of them. And for their part, they do not seem to be afraid of me. I sit and eat quietly the bread of resistance on the wrong side of the barricade. I am an elder, shining and wise. I have lived my words. I have discovered the use of my heart, my mind, my tongue. And for that reason alone, I have become devout, a listener devoted to the sound of the human voice. I have lived long enough to be able to tell you that I prefer it to sound happy. For the sake of the generations, I have become magic. I have become the ear that speaks. I would like to present these candles to Howard and Studs. You should light them and remember that you have many friends who love you in Berkeley, that to us you are yourselves candles that light up the darkness of silence. Studs and Howie.
We are wired. So there is a good possibility this may find itself in the hands of the independent counsel. And if it does, it'll be great. We're cinched to make headlines tomorrow. Yes, sir.
I want to say something about Alice first. You're not supposed to say something about the person who introduces you. You're supposed to forget about them. You know, they introduce you, go home, right? But no, I have to say something about Alice. And not just, you know, to boast that she was my student. I tried not to do that. But I just want to say one thing about, there's lots I could say about her. When she was in my class, quiet. And then she wrote this fantastic paper as a sophomore on Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, which absolutely staggered me. But I just want to tell you one thing. I was at the University of Hawaii, speaking at the University of Hawaii some years ago, and then I was in a student cafeteria and with this bunch of students, and then a student sitting opposite me had this book in front of her, The Color Purple. Well, I did not immediately say, oh, she was my student. I have tremendous self-control. I just said, oh, are you reading the how do you like it? She looked at me and she said, this book changed my life. Well, what more can you say about a book and about a person who wrote that book? But I want to tell you about Studs now remembers Alice, right? But, I didn't know that Studs had interviewed Alice. I want to tell you when I met Studs in, we'll see if he remembers this, you see. But in 1964, I had just come up from 7 years in the South teaching at Spelman, where Alice was, and being involved in the civil rights movement, and I wrote a couple of books, one SNCC, The New Abolitionists, and the other called The Southern Mystique, and the publisher was sending me around, you know, as they do, and they said, this person in Chicago, Studs Terkel, who's he? At that time, Studs, you were famous in Chicago, but
infamous in some quarters.
Yeah, but I didn't know. I really didn't know. But two things stood out about Studs' interview with me. One is, and this follows right upon what Alice said. He was the first interviewer who had read my book. And I remember once I was, in one of my books, I was interviewed on the Today Show, and they conveyed me in a stretch limousine, three blocks from my hotel to NBC Studios. Studs did not have a limousine for me. He did not have anything for me. But the Today people had not read my book, and he had. And that to me was a great thing. One other thing about that. After our interview, I went back to my hotel. I didn't know anybody in Chicago, and the phone rang. It was Studs. He said, "What are you doing tonight?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Well, Ida and I have an extra ticket to the Pete Seeger concert." That was a great evening.
You know, as the boy says to the girl when he wants to make out, "Let's talk about you." And this is, I like the way he casually says he taught at Spelman and was there. He happened to be one of the heroes of Freedom Summer. Howard Zinn tells stories, not about himself, but about that. But he is in it at all times. And the book called The Southern Mystique, the one talking about, he coined a phrase I never forgot. It's called the hierarchy of values. And it's one of the most key revelatory phrases I know in determining what is good. Would you mind explaining that? I'll lead into you. I'll lead into you. Okay. It's the segregated Atlanta, and it's an opening of My Fair Lady Touring Company. Right? My Fair Lady Touring Company, and you know, African-Americans on the balcony, segregated. A couple of members of the athletic team, two guys who are black, and two beautiful girls of the drama department, dressed very elegantly. Howard gives them four tickets. He bought four tickets, and they got fifth row center tickets. Why don't you pick up from there?
Actually, Studs. It was like, yeah, there were about seven people from the drama department. The director, who looked like Othello, actors and actresses, all elegantly dressed. They'd been, you might say, they'd been dressed by the designer for their stage productions, and we had bought tickets for them. Actually, I didn't buy the ticket, Studs. It was a colleague of mine, Henry West, a white Southerner who was teaching at Spelman College, and he went downtown and he bought tickets, as you say, front row center, seven tickets. And they, armed with these tickets, they presented them, and the person taking the tickets was sort of staggered. Black people did not come to the municipal auditorium. But they presented their tickets and walked in before he could do anything. And they sat down, front row center. There was excitement in the hall. you could see the... finally, one of them called the mayor.
Now, Hartsfield.
Mayor Hartsfield, right. The Atlanta airport is now named after him. Mayor Hartsfield. He said, "You know, this is the situation. What shall we do?" Well, Hartsfield was the first liberal mayor of Atlanta, sort of had a certain kind of wisdom. Hartsfield said, "My advice to you is to turn out the lights."
And, you see, that's what Howard meant by the hierarchy of values. Because the crowd was getting very impatient. They want to see 15 half hours. They want to see My Fair Lady. So what is more important that moment? Was it that thing called segregation, a ritual? Or was it the fact they want to see a play? They paid dough to see a play, and that's the important thing. You pointed out something else, another case. There's a kid from a racist family. He's in a play, Finian's Rainbow.
Right.
And you remember Finian's Rainbow, and there's the leprechaun, Og. And he's, but it's with a mixed cast. And he's been taught, his father's a mill owner somewhere in Carolina. The kid,
right.
His father's a virulent racist, and the kid is taught that way. He's never been on the stage before with black, let alone making love to a black girl who's Suzanne. And as you told me that story, as I read it, it says, he can't be with her. At the same time, he loves that role so much. It's so good. He loved being, he did it, and it altered his life. That's called hierarchy of values. And I thought I learned that from you. And during the Selma Montgomery march, on the evening when they were performing, they were marching from Selma to Montgomery. The evening before, though, there was a gathering at St. Jude's, and all these celebrities were there and all. I decided I want to go to town and meet some of the townspeople, some Klansmen, others. That's the way I work. And so I went there. And so I'm at the mailbox, Commerce and Bibb Street. And they're furious, it seems. These two guys, they're so sympathetic to the Klan, but not. They say, by the way, I said, Jim Clark of nearby Selma said, never. Oh, no such thing as never. They said that. It gave me a hunch. They were baseball fans, too. And the Volunteers, the name of the team, the Montgomery Volunteers, or Farm Club of the Detroit Tigers. And they had, for the first, a black player named Gates Brown. I said, how do you guys feel? You're for segregation. Oh, yeah, we're for segregation, absolutely. Well, then, you wouldn't go to that ball game, would you, the black player? The hell we wouldn't. We want to see the guys play. He's a good player. So that is hierarchy of values. And so, in a sense, that's from you.
Now, let me say something about that word never. Because people always, right, people always say never. You say, but then circumstances change and it's not never anymore. What you said about the Selma to Montgomery march, that was in 1965, some of you may remember that, you know, the first before that there'd been an attempt at a march from Selma to Montgomery, and the march had been broken up by Al Lingo and the state troopers of Alabama with their clubs who beat bloody the people who were crossing the Pettus Bridge in Selma. And now this was another march, and this time it was going to take place. And this time, for the first time, the federal government, which up to that point had been really so reluctant to do anything to oppose local policemen and local thugs, the role of the FBI, the role of the Justice Department, the role of the Kennedys in those years of the Civil Rights Movement was not something to be proud of. But now, finally, in 1965, there was a nationwide uproar that had been about that first thing that happened in that first attempt at a march. And so with that national uproar, Lyndon Johnson decided that he would actually protect the marchers this time and send the army along with the marchers. But I was on the last leg of the march from Selma to Montgomery, we'd spent the night in a sort of soaked in mud. It had rained and rained and rained, and everybody was sleeping on this field, and it was a field of mud. And so we walked that last sort of 18 miles into Montgomery, and then I decided there was going to be a ceremony, and Martin Luther King Jr. was going to speak, and other people, and people had come in from various places, and I really didn't want to stay for that. I wanted to get home. I always want to get home. And I've copped out of a lot of things just to get home, you see. And I mean, a real revolutionary would never do that. You know, real revolutionary never goes home, you see. I went to the Atlanta airport, Montgomery Airport, to get on a plane to go home and back to Boston. And there at the Atlanta airport, I ran into Whitney Young. Whitney Young was a friend and a colleague from Atlanta University. He had been head of the School of Social Work, and now he was head of the Urban League. And he had come in for the final sort of rally in Montgomery. He'd just come in on a plane. And so we sat down. We decided we'd have a cup of coffee together. And so we went into this cup of coffee at the airport in Montgomery, Alabama. And it was, the two of us sat down. I was splattered with mud. Whitney Young was elegant, and he's a handsome guy, and he was elegantly dressed, and the two of us must have been sort of an interesting picture. And the waitress who came over to serve us sort of did not know what to do, but she took our order, and then I saw on her uniform, she had this big button which said, never. And she served us. People change.
Okay, the word never brings to mind a story about a man named C.P. Ellis, Claiborne P. Ellis, former Grand Cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan, Durham, North Carolina. Now, I heard about this guy, C.P. Ellis, who has now changed somewhat. In fact, he's traveling the country with an African-American woman named Ann Atwater and talking on behalf of the janitors' unions, custodial unions. C.P., I go to see him. Hard to get to him. He doesn't want to talk about it. But finally, I get to him, and he tells me the story. He's a poor white. All his life, he was taught that everything that happened to him, and things happened to him, one thing went wrong after another, four kids, one kid, hopelessly retarded. He tries one thing, loses, another thing, loses. His father was a Klansman, told him it's the fault of black people. It's their fault. He's taught this all his life, you see. And bit by bit, he decides he's told to join the Klan. Oh, and join the Klan because he could be somebody. And he says, tells me, and this is an interesting sequence in his life. He says, Studs, I gotta tell you what it was joining the Klan. I'm a nobody, you see. But they put that robe on me, and these are some big shots in town. Put the robe on me, put the hood on me, and I'm walking down that dimly lit auditorium toward that illuminated cross. And suddenly I felt like I was somebody. Now, who used that phrase? You are somebody. Jesse Jackson, Operation Push, says, you are somebody. Well, this guy, for perverse reasons, felt he was somebody. Mm-hmm. Now he joins the Klan, and now he's helping breaking up civil rights marches. But the woman he most hates and loathes is a black woman named Ann Atwater, a working woman who's organized the kids and others to protest the stores not hiring black help. And he used to break up the picket lines, and he's honored. That every night he's called up by a big shot and says, C.P., you were great. You did great, Claiborne. And the next day, that's when he first started seeing things. Things weren't getting any better for him. The next day, he's walking down the street, and the same big shot congratulates him, crosses to the other side of the street, not to be seen with him. He says, wait a minute. Am I being used? First time he thought of that. And then he sees a black guy going by. He's that guy's as raggedy as I am. Is he the one? Bit by bit, it's starting to hit him. Wait a minute, something's going on here. Well, during the time of Jimmy Carter, this time, there was it was a $1 million grant to the town of Durham, to the school, for Corrette's, somebody's called again, certain libraries of the school. And he's invited an African-American guy in town, insurance man who's very hip to everything, invites White Citizens Councils, NAACP, SNCC, Klan, invites them all to come. They all got kids. They got something in common. They got kids. And he said he's going to go to it too. And his fellow Klansmen said, are you out of your mind? Are you going to go with them? He said, well, I got a kid going to school. I didn't want them to have all the money. Hierarchy of values again. And so he goes to attend the session. It's a wild session. This black guy is the chairman, and he's calling them racists. They're calling him racist. And this guy who's chairman says, after they name Ann Atwater as head of the committee to continue, they got to go on, a continuing committee, he says, I nominate someone I think is a very honest man, C.P. Ellis as co-chairman with Ann Atwater. Now it's very funny as he tells this moment. He says, my mind was going crazy. I'm out of my mind. This mad guy's calling me a good man, an honest man. And he's I was going out of my mind. So what's the guy trying to do? Turn me upside down. But I figure I got a kid. She's got a kid. I don't want her kid to have everything. So I say, okay, we shake hands. We shake hands, and we're going to meet. It's a truce. I don't like you. You don't like me. And then later on, I met Ann Atwater. She picks up the story. I come back to see. And that was he's a very religious man, and I'm religious. And he came to one of our sessions, and we were singing hymns he recognized. And as soon as he started tapping his feet like that, I knew we had him. So C.P. now picks up the story. Now, C.P. finally got a job as a janitor at Duke University, and Terry Sanford, a very liberal guy, was the head of Duke, and he recognized something about Ellis as this guy, James Clement, this African-American guy, something about this guy. Well, he became active in the janitors' union, strong union man, it's 80% black women, and he becomes a tremendous organizer of the union, and he's going to run for business agent, full-time job. His opponent is a black man. He knows they haven't got a ghost of a chance, 80% black women. He gets up to say, you know who I am, C.P. Ellis, and I'm running for the job of this. And the women say, sit down, we know who you are, sit down. He said, I'm going to get, guess what? They elected me 4-1. And that's when he broke into sobs. He's those women. Those women, he says, there was no Martin Luther King holiday. It was going to be, and they insisted there be a Martin Luther King holiday, and all the other people use that day now for their own stuff. But those women, they and me can hold our own against those college-educated strike breakers who come in. We hold our own. Suddenly, Steds, I feel like I'm somebody. Now, that's the story of C.P. Ellis. So, there is no...
Yeah. I'm going to change your microphone.
There's no such thing as never. That's C.P. Ellis. That's the point you were making about no never.
I'm glad. Since you've talking about hierarchy of values, Studs, what you said reminded me, and talking about change and how people and what the possibilities are and how we very often give up on people. We categorize them. I hear, this person is a white racist, as if that person must remain a white racist forever. This last summer, we had a conference in Boston on race and racism in the 90s. It was a kind of bringing together of people who some of the people who from the civil rights movement in the 60s in the South, and young people, students of today. And the idea was to have some, make some connection between that generation and this and share whatever we could share. And one of the people who came to this conference was a guy I had known in Mississippi. He was a white guy who came down, didn't come down just for the summer of 1964. He came down and stayed. And he worked in this little town, Holly Springs, Mississippi. And he was organizing brick workers who worked in the factory. He was working in the black community. He was living in the black community, working with black people, organizing black people. And, Mississippi is Mississippi. Anybody who worked in Mississippi, anybody who worked in the movement, and of course the black people even who didn't work in the movement, you had to always be somewhat scared in Mississippi. He was staying in what was called a Freedom House, where civil rights workers worked. And one day there was a knock on the door, and he opens it, and the deputy sheriff is there. And he would recognize that deputy sheriff as somebody who had really been brutal and had arrested people and cuffed people around. And white people who worked among black people in the South were not loved by the law enforcement officers of Mississippi. And the deputy sheriff said to him, come with me. didn't think he had much choice. There was no place to run. got into his car, took him out into the woods, into an isolated area, and my friend was getting more and more scared by the minute, because this was sort of a typical situation. And they got out of the car, nobody around. The deputy sheriff says to him, "You've been organizing in this brick factory, haven't you?" "Well, sort of." A lot of lying went on in the movement. He said, I know you've been organizing. You've been organizing those black workers in a brick factory. He said, "But you know, there are also white workers in the brick factory, and one of them is my brother. And these white workers need to be organized, so I'd like to get some of your material."
Now, I got to ask Howard Zinn a question. He's been teaching now at school for years. We hear more and more talk about apathy on the campus. Hear this continuous apathy. And now, what do you find? Now, also, there's a proviso here that is, you have certain... You, Howard Zinn, have classes, and they're large classes, but certain kinds of students come to your class. They may not be typical, but how do you find the campus?
Well, when you say certain kinds of students come to my class...
Yeah.
What do you...
No, I mean kids who are interested.
No.
Kids who are interested in what's going on.
Yeah. Well...
Maybe I'm wrong. Am I restricting it too much?
Yeah, a little, yeah. Because... It's true there were... Look, I taught in the last sort of 8 or 10 years that I taught at Boston University, I had 400 students each semester. It wasn't a required course, but 400 students signed up in my course each semester.
Wait, this is about the biggest, isn't it, on the campus? It's about the biggest. No, I mean, this is important.
It was big.
In other words, you get all kinds of students then.
That's the point.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. That's, you know, there may have been 12 radicals who came to my class, you know, the special kind. But I also had hockey players and students in the School of Engineering and students in the School of Journalism and students in the business school, all sorts of students. Don't ask me why they came to my class. I think they heard it was interesting. But what I found, and this was in the 80s, I'm talking about the 80s now, the...
Reagan time, this is Reagan.
Oh, Reagan, I forgot about him, yeah. Reagan, yeah. Reagan and Bush, right? And everybody was saying how students in the 80s are apathetic and students are conservative and actually they always say this about students, you know, unless students are, you know, creating a great national commotion, there's a general statement that people make about students, you know, that they're apathetic and they don't care and so on. Now I found that here we were in the 80s and I found that my students, for these 400 students, we had tremendously lively discussions all the time about the race question, about class, about economic justice, about militarism, about war. I had ROTC students in my class, and these students were interested. And you know, I think what caused the notion that they were apathetic was simply that there was no great national movement as there was during the Civil Rights Movement, during the Vietnam War, no central issue dramatic enough and big enough to create a national student movement. But, you know, students are always one inch away from such a movement.
See, now Howard is touching on something. During the 60s, there were causes that outside the personal sphere or ambition of there was a civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam, causes outside themselves. There's a woman named Joan Nestle. Do you know her? I never heard of her until I read this comment of hers. She says, It is fashionable to put down the 60s by those who delight in the failure of dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about this comment. You watch the 60s put down. So I'm watching, for example, Meet the Press. I don't know why I watch, but I watch Meet the Press, you know. And there you got, you have the conservative George Will and the liberal, God help us, Sam Donaldson. And they both have a great time putting down the 60s. They found a token figure. They found Jan Wenner, who was not the greatest, but he was then on the Rolling Stone. And they lacerated him in the 60s. And just the whole aspect, it was the one moment. Now, in this matter of Howard, he's a certain kind of teacher. And of course, he reaches out to people. So I'm in Wabash College, a lecture. Wabash College, Edwardsville, Indiana, is about as right-wing as you could get. They're farmers kids, good kids, but they were taught. Their parents loved Reagan, of course. They were taught this. It's all male. It's one intergender. No, and they're very much to the right, the kids are. So I'm saying my stuff, as I'm doing right here at the end, there's a standing ovation. Not because of me, but because they never heard this stuff before. And so there's this little gathering, after a little gathering of wine and cheese gathering, and the kids come up and say, is what you say true? I said, yeah. But they never heard it. And that's what it's about, of course.
You know, it's interesting, Studs. I've had the same experiences. I was invited, I don't know, 5-6 years ago to speak at California Polytech, which is in San Luis Obispo. And this is and I've been warned by the faculty member who invited me. He said, look, you know, these are very conservative students. Well, 900 of them paid money.
Now, yeah.
I don't know, maybe they didn't know what they were coming getting into, you see. But 900 of them paid to get in. And I don't think it was because they paid the money that they felt that they had to applaud. You see, I wouldn't like to think that. You see, but the fact is, I was talking as radical as I could, you know, and I can. And I was talking to them the way I would talk to students anywhere, to anybody anywhere. I was talking about the distribution of wealth. I was talking about war and militarism. I was talking about racism. I was talking about the need for a transformation of society and so on and so forth. And they gave me this, you know. And I think what that says, your experience and mine, and you know, I Noam Chomsky and I compare notes from time to time because everywhere I go to speak, he has been, you see. And if he hasn't been, he will be there. You see, it's very disconcerting. I go into a place and there are these Noam Chomsky posters all over the place. But he and I compare notes. And he has this experience too. And you know, and Noam Chomsky is unsparing. I mean, he's not like you and me. I mean, we're sort of, you know, easygoing and you know. Noam Chomsky is you know. But huge numbers of people come out to hear him. And they listen to him, and they learn from him. And I think what this suggests is that we have been, in a way, deceived by the media into thinking that, you know, into thinking that that the American people are swallowing what the politicians are telling them.
This is the key, one of the keys throughout. This can't be overemphasized. The use of phrases and where the word yuppie is used. I use the word a great deal. There are yuppies, those who are traders who want to make a buck or two no matter what. The great many of the young we know are lost and bewildered and worried about jobs and what's going to happen, the great many. But this is a couple of yuppies. It concerns labor. We have to talk a little about labor. We've read about that sad contract signed by the UAW. You probably know the harvest, I think, after 7 years, and they were defeated. Outside of UPS victory, which is rather interesting, we can talk about that. But labor's beating. And many of the young are anti-labor. Just like the kids at Wabash College. Of course, they were never told anything different. They don't know. And so I'm standing on the corner. It's the neighborhood I live in. Now, this is an anecdote. It's 95% true. But I'm standing on the corner. It's a have and have not community. But this is a half street. I'm waiting for the bus, and there's this handsome young couple. He's reading his Wall Street Journal under his arm, and she's a Bergdorf Goodman or Bloomingdale clothes, has the latest issue of Vanity Fair in her sweet little hand. And they're there, and I can't make conversation with them. Every day, wait for the bus, I talk to myself a lot. And I find the audience very appreciative. And so I'm saying, conversation. Well, I say, just to make conversation, Labor Day is coming up. It's the wrong thing to say. And so I say, he turns away from me, looks at me as Noel Coward observing a cockroach. And he says, and I'm dressed, and I have all kinds of papers in my hand. And so now I'm challenged. I say, Labor Day, we march down State Street, Chicago's Main Street, singing Solidarity Forever, UAWCIO. And he turns and he says, we loathe unions. And say, I got a pigeon right here. And I say, whoa. And the bus is late and coming. There's no bus. So I say, oh. I say, and now I'm the Ancient Mariner, fixing him with a glittering eye. And I'm saying, how many hours a day do you work? It's a non-sequitur. He says, well, 8. How come you don't work 18, 20 hours a day? Your great-grandparents, did you know why you work 8 hours a day? Because 4 guys got hanged in Chicago fighting for the 8-hour day for you. It's the Haymarket Affair. You realize it's very unfair. All's fair in love and war. You know, and now, no bus. Come yet. So I got him pinned against the mailbox. He can't get away. And meantime, she's nervous. It's very beautiful because she drops the Vanity Fair. I pick it up with a low bow. I give it to her, you know. And then I say, by the way, how many hours a week do you work? And he say 40. This time they're trembling a little, you know. And I say, you know why how come you don't work 80 hours a day like your great-grandparents did? Because people got their heads busted in the 30s fighting with a 40-hour week for you. The bus comes on. They go on. I never saw them again. But I'll bet on the 35th floor of that high-rise, that upscale high-rise, she's looking out the window, and he's saying, is that old nut still down there? Well, now that's an easy story to tell. But the fact is, why blame them? They just don't know. You come back to the media again and what's happening, you see. And this is what we're battling, of course, down through the years, basically.
But, you know, I think we're seeing, despite this, you know, you're right, some bad contracts are being signed. I think there's some new energy in the labor movement. And I think it comes from, partly from some, you know, new people coming up, partly from a recognition that there's a whole unorganized mass of people who need to be organized. Just as in the 1930s, the CIO recognized there's a whole mass of unorganized people needed to be organized. But I think part of the impetus for this new energy comes simply from the fact that there's a recognition of how much wealth has gravitated to the top while working people have seen their wages stagnate.
Absolutely.
And you know, we have things, the beginnings of things that have great promise, like Union Summer, where they're bringing young people are spending their summer, the Freedom Summer of Mississippi.
Yeah.
And about last October, a year ago October, I got a call in the sometime in the morning from one of those people who calls you when something is going on, you know, an organizer type, you know, the kind of person who, you know, I don't call people, you see, I just wait to be called, you see, but there are people who call, and this person, actually a wonderful person, head of the trade union program at Harvard, a woman from Canada, a socialist, a fighter, but she is on the case all the time. She calls me and says, Howard, there's these people in this factory north of Boston, in this town of Everett, the Richmark factory, they make curtains. The people who work there are Salvadoran women, immigrants, and they're working for less than the minimum wage. They have to take work home, and they get paid virtually nothing. They're not allowed to go to the bathroom for more than 3 minutes without their pay being docked. I mean, they work under horrible conditions. And, you know, we have many of those situations now around the country. We have sweatshops. We have as many sweatshops in New York today as we did at the turn of the century. And so Unite, this new union, which is a, you know,
service employees.
They've begun to organize these people, they got a majority of the people signed up. Whereupon, immediately, 10 of the people inside the plant were fired. And so we're going to have a demonstration outside the plant. And, you know, will you be there, because we need community support. So, I went, because I don't want her to, you know, I can't, she's one of those people you can't say no to. So I went, and there was a great, you know, nice rally in front of the factory. And then about 13 of us went into the factory to talk to the boss, and to ask him to recognize the union and to retake these fired workers. No way. We said, we're not going to leave until you do. So he calls the police. Police in Everett, the police come. The police chief of Everett comes. He has nothing else to do. There's not much going on in Everett, you see. And they've never been confronted with a situation like this. They're not accustomed to it, so they're sort of hesitant about what to do. But they say, we're going to have to arrest you for trespassing, and we want to apologize because we don't have enough handcuffs to go around. Anyway, they arrest us, and we spend some time in jail before we're bailed out. 3 days, and there's a story in the newspaper the next day, a story in the Boston Globe. And one of the reasons for the story, I think, is because the AFL-CIO president, John Sweeney, was in town, and Elaine Bernard, the same telephone person, called him and said, come down and speak at his rally. He did, came down and speak at the rally. And so there's a story about the people arrested, you know, John Sweeney spoke at the rally and so on, and they named the factory, and they named the owner and so on. And 3 days later, I got another call from Elaine Bernard. And I want to say this, that the people of the 13 people, about 4 of them were young people, students, who had been participating in Union Summer. And then one was a Catholic priest, 2 were members of the Teamsters Union, 3 were members of the Electrical Workers Union, community organizers, and so on. Three days later, the company has agreed to hire back the workers. They're going to sign a contract with the union. It took a little community solidarity and a little militancy to do that.
Just to add, absolutely. Thank you. Just to add to what Howard's been saying. By the way, you always give me hope when I meet you. This is great. Just to add to what he's been saying, the UPS strike. United Parcel Service strike was that sign of that new spirit. But more important than that, it was able to convince most Americans. Remember, the great many people were for the strike. It's for the first time since the horrible days when Ronald Reagan first acted in office broke the air controller strike in 1980. By the way, the air controller strike, just in case you don't know, was the union of air control overwhelmingly pro-Ronald Reagan. They voted 80% for Reagan. They were promised something he double-crossed. Remember, he broke the strike. 80% of America applauded Ronald Reagan. You know what the strike was about? I'm coming to the UPS strike in a minute, the big change. The strike of the air controllers was for passenger safety. You read more and more about near misses, unseasoned air controllers. They were striking for health benefits, for time off in case of fatigue and nervous breakdown, medical help. And we read about more and more close shaves, near misses, unseasoned air controllers. He blacklisted 11,000 seasoned air controllers and never came back. It was for passenger safety. 80% of Americans applauded. I start thinking, have we become a necrophilic people? She's pushing it. But the point is, labor's had a rough time, but Howard's pointing out the young, the new kind of employees, service employees, and the UPS strike. And why did most Americans recognize that? Because they saw something happen. The word is temps, temporaries. A temporary, George and Lenny of Mice and Men were temps. They were hired, they worked at ranches, right, for day laborers. You find temps, not on ranches, in law firms, in banks, insurance companies. People recognize, hey, that could be someone working next to me. And suddenly that's what C.P. Ellis recognized as well. It's this question of revelations, little daily revelations. And the way you teach is a factor in all that. But there is something popping.
Yeah. Since you're saying nice things about me, Stud, I'm trying desperately to find something nice to say about you. I mean, it's not easy, of course. But when you read Studs Terkel's interviews, you see what. I must tell you this, that I want to talk about oral history, because that's. You'll agree, that's what you're known for. Among other things, I mean, you're known for acting, for singing, for all sorts of things, but for being a great disc jockey, but oral history is your thing.
Oral history's been around long before any of us were born.
Yeah, but let's not talk about the others, okay? I want to tell you this. In the early 1960s, when I was in the South in the movement, and I was going around Albany, Georgia, and Selma, and various Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and so on, and I thought history is being made right in front of our eyes. Fantastic things are going on, and it's not being recorded. And I remember that I had gone to Columbia University. I don't like to admit it, but when I went to Columbia University, there was an oral history project. It was sort of a pioneering thing, an oral history project at Columbia University. And I knew what the oral history project was, because I had used some of its stuff. And what it consisted of was interviews with famous people who were about to die. You see, because they always, when they were, they're looking to do interviews, they try to find somebody just before they go, because they don't want to miss out. And so interviewing ex-admirals and ex-generals and ex-secretaries of state and retired, joint chiefs of staff and industrialists and so on, that was the Oral History Project. Anyway, I wrote from the South to the Columbia Oral History Project. And I said, look, there's fantastic oral history to be done down here. Come to Selma, listen to the Selma Freedom Chorus. Mm-hmm. Come to a church meeting and record. Right. Come to Greenwood, Mississippi and talk to Mrs. Ruby Pilcher, who lives next to the Freedom House. And this is amazing stuff. Just send a few people down here with tape recorders. I got a letter back. Saying, an excellent idea. Whenever you get a letter back, which starts off, an excellent idea, something else is coming. An excellent idea. But we don't have the resources to do this. Columbia University doesn't have the resources to do it. Studs Terkel had the resources to do it. Studs Terkel, with his,
way back.
With his little tape recorder, which he barely knew how to use.
I still goof it up. I almost lost Bertrand Russell.
Now this not too many people can say
that. Cuban Missile Crisis. I don't quite know how to work the thing, but it's a long way. Somehow I got a half hour with him in North Wales. And he's furious at Kennedy because two guys, Nehru and Khrushchev, replied to his cables. Kennedy ignored him. And he says, you're president. I said, not my president, just a minute, But anyway, I'm trying to, I got him. It's all set to go when I turned on the wrong knob. And then I realized, just about to say, well, young man, I didn't have it on. And last minute I got it. And if I missed him, I'd have put my head in the oven. But I've missed Martha Graham. I'm a magician. I make people disappear. I lost Martha Graham. I lost Michael Redgrave. I almost lost Jacques Tati. You know Jacques Tati? Well, Jacques Tati, I almost scooped up. He was delighted. He said, "That's what I mean about machines," he said. Later on we did it. But it's my ineptitude that sometimes an asset. You're talking to someone, a hard-working person, non-celebrity, a guy with a microphone, and that person sees the guy with the microphone very inept and very goofy with the machine. In the days when before the cassette had reels, and I forgot, and the reel wasn't working. And that Appalachian woman says, or this woman in a housing project says, "Look, the reel's not working." I said, "Oh, I forgot." And so that person feels pretty good. Yeah. Because that person feels needed by me.
Yeah.
And I think that's a key.
Yeah.
I think people have to feel needed by somebody.
You know, somewhere in one of your books, Studs, I confuse your various books. But in one of your books, you said that there's a difference between interviewing celebrities and interviewing non-celebrities. And the celebrities rarely astonished you by what they said.
Yeah.
The thing that I always loved about your work, you see, and the interviews you did, is that what you showed in these interviews was that people who are not celebrities had not only courage, but wisdom. Because very often it's acknowledged that ordinary people without education and so on, that they have courage. But it's not very often acknowledged how wise they are. You know, like that Appalachian woman that you interviewed in one of your interviews.
Peggy Terry.
That was, yeah. And she said, remember what she said about Howard Hughes? Do you remember?
Forget. She was great. Well, Peggy Terry, her name is.
Yeah.
She talked about and about working in a defense plant during the war, and her stuff would just flowed. It just flowed naturally.
She said, "Why, how come they don't refer to this multimillionaire Howard Hughes as a welfare bum?"
Yeah, that's
you
right.
See.
By the way, she had the same wit as Yip Harburg, the great songwriter, E.Y. Harburg. The man who wrote Brother Can You Spare a Dime, Finian's Rainbow. In that, the song called, not Necessity, "When a poor man doesn't want to work, he's a bum. When a rich man doesn't work, he's a gay bon vivant." And so, in a sense, Peggy Terry had what Yip Harburg had. Isn't it? The same. It's that, this is old stuff, what I'm doing. You know, Zora Neale Hurston, during WPA days, WPA, Writers' Project, Zora Neale Hurston recorded the work of black people in the South, and Henry Mayhew, a very Englishman, a contemporary of Dickens, recorded London's Labour and London's Poor. For the first time, the respectable so-called heard these people's voices, and they were stunned and amazed. So it's an old tale. I guess
it's old in other countries, and England had seen that. Mayhew did it in the 1850s and so on. But in our country, our histories have been so much the histories told from the top and the histories of important people, and that when you came out with your interviews with people whose names nobody had ever heard of, but who had these marvelous things to say and these great insights, I mean that was a contribution unparalleled, really.
Thank you. But the thing in my favor is also a new machine, the tape recorder. See, two people I've known have been possessed by the tape recorder: Richard Nixon and me. In fact, I think I call myself and Richard Nixon neo-Cartesians. We say, "I tape, therefore I am."
Yeah.
But I hope it's used. I hope it's been used for different purposes.
Yeah.
But true, the tape recorder is a factor.
I want to talk about something else that you've said. I remember you were talking about how you were on a debating team when you were in school, right? And they gave you questions, should we grant independence to the Philippines? And and you were saying, oh, this is the proper time to raise this, since it's 100 years after the Spanish-American War, right, 1898, 100 years after we begin this bloody war in the Philippines. But why didn't anybody ask the question, what right do we have to grant independence
to the Philippines? Who the hell are we to grant them their independence?
That's right. Yeah. But then you go on to generalize from that, and you say, there are certain questions that are impertinent, you know, that are outside the scheme. And those are the questions that should be answered. It's like, you know, today with what's going on in Iraq. You know, the issue is, should we bomb Iraq, or should we also invade?
Yeah.
And that's the debate you hear in the press, really. And, you know, by the way, the one, you know, while I, you know, in general, I can't find anything decent that is said, especially on public television. The public does not appear on public television.
No.
Think
of the programs on public television as called left-wing television. You got the Buckley Show, you got McLaughlin, you got the Capitol. You got right down the line, you've got Olin, you got Heritage, you got Rockford. Unbelievable.
And the Jim Lehrer News Hour, you know, they always trundle out four or five characters, and the difference among, in their opinions is a hairbreadth, if anything. You see, but there was something refreshing and different last week, and I don't know if any of you caught it.
Cynthia and that is, McKinney.
That's right.
Cynthia,
that's right. They had these three blokes. I shouldn't call them blokes. They're Congress people. Let's see. Two Republicans and one Democrat, but you couldn't tell who was who. You know, it didn't matter, right? And they were all in those three were arguing about whether we should, you know, just bomb or whether we should do more than bomb, you know. But Cynthia McKinney, black congresswoman from Georgia, was fantastic. I mean, she stood up to these guys. She wouldn't take any guff. She interrupted. She wouldn't be silenced. She wouldn't be intimidated. And she had her facts. And she was passionate, and she spoke out against this, you know. And she raised what you call the impertinent questions, you know. And it was just a pleasure to hear her.
You know, I was thinking, Howard and I can go on, as you know, but we're also aware we got to have questions from the audience, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
How are we for time? We got a million things to say, I know that.
But. Yeah, I mean, looking at my watch won't tell me a thing, because I have no idea when we started or when we're supposed to finish.
Oh, ask, what'd you say? I didn't hear you.
Yeah, no, I was saying that looking at my watch won't tell me a thing, because I don't remember when we started, when we...
Bob. Know. What do you think? I'd love to go on with this.
There's somebody who tells us what to do, yeah.
How about maybe 10 minutes of questions and answers? You're going to hook a mic down so we can get them direct.
Oh, well, before we do that, I promised, and somebody called me to remind all of you about the fact that there's a table out there for signatures, a table run by the Students for Educational Opportunity. And the idea is to get the gathering of signatures to put the Equal Educational Opportunity Initiative on the November ballot. And the idea basically is to restore affirmative action in California. I think very often when we gather 900, 1,000 people together, and we don't take advantage of the opportunity to have them do even one little thing. But today, you can do more than one little thing. You can give money, and you can sign things out there. You can buy literature and so on. But the table will be out there. So, should we go to the audience?
All right. Fire away.
I think what we'll do, though, is have people come up to here and speak into this mic so it's clear throughout the house. So we can only take a handful of people. Good, here's someone. Also, occasionally, when questions and answers happen, a few people leave. We have something for you when you are leaving. We have excerpted a wonderful speech, a talk, a series of comments Studs gave a couple of months ago when he won a National Book Award. It's called Histories, Etc., and I think it's really eloquent, and there's a copy for everyone here. Yeah.
My question's for Howard Zinn. Nice to see you again. I went to Boston University 72 to 76. Arrived there in 72, the year after John Silber got there. It's amazing that you're here, you are well, you are heard, and he is out. And I want to know, during those incredible times, those years, your time with him and his time with you, how did it end up? How did it end up? He did not know what to do with you because he was trying to create this powerful Harvard on the other side of the river, and there you were, but you were the most popular professor on campus, and he didn't know quite what to do with you, and I just wanted to know how it ended up.
Well, see, he was limited. He had no nuclear weapons. Okay. If he could have acquired them, he would have. I mean, this is a guy, you know, who, we're not just talking about campus politics, right? He's a guy who believed in, you know, sending arms to El Salvador, you know, to the death squad government of El Salvador, and refused to give an honorary degree to Mandela. And, you know, I could go on. Yeah. But what happened with us, it was a standoff. He had his office and his money and his buildings and his trees, you know, and I had these 400 students every semester, you see. And so, you know, it would drive him crazy because he would not allow me to have any teaching assistants, you see. And he sent a letter that the department head actually was a good, very decent person, showed me the letter that he got. The letter said, if Zinn will cut his class down to 80 students, I will give him teaching assistants. But anyway, Boston University was like a microcosm of the world. You know, we were, Silber, people talk about Silber as the Idi Amin of higher education. No. But we resisted. There's one interesting thing about the history, and that is in 1979, we went on strike at Boston University. The professors went on strike, the secretaries went on strike, the librarians went on strike, the buildings and grounds workers went on strike. We had like almost an IWW general strike at Boston University. Yeah, and we won.
That's right.
You see.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here and for being out there. We need you. And it's been wonderful hearing everything you've had to say. I just believe in it so strongly. But you said one thing that sounded, it didn't sound like it had enough depth coming from the two of you. And I don't know if it's because there's just a little time. But as a former member of the mainstream media, I left my job at the Boston Globe to become the first business agent of the Boston Globe Employees Association. We had a lot to do to change that union from one where a white man used the presidency to become a member of upper management. We were successful in changing that. And I went on from there to a well-known women's college, which shall remain unnamed, and had to fight there to get a women's studies major approved. So when you talk about the media being so responsible for people or children not being educated or young people not knowing, I want to pull back and say, well, yes, the media is dreadful about that, but it seems like there's a whole education system out there that plays into that. And unless you're suggesting that the media controls our system of public and private education and our publishing systems.
I'm just thinking media control. NBC is owned by General Electric, right? Mm-hmm. You think Tom Brokaw is going to curse General Electric, be out on his ass tomorrow, right?
Right.
Dan Rather, he could talk about Westinghouse, which owns CBS. Do you think Peter Jennings can talk about Disney Corp, which owns ABC? You think a guy on Fox can talk about Murdoch? You got more and more. Yeah, more and more controlled by less and less and less. We know this.
Right,
so.
And I couldn't agree more.
We talk about corporate America. Basically, that's what it amounts to, corporate America. And so it's the alternative stuff. Having him as a teacher, reading magazines such as Nation and These Times Progressive, that's all part of the battle. The cards are stacked. You got to start right. The cards are stacked. You got to play pretty sharp games through our lives, pretty hard.
I agree with you, and I know how front pages and back pages are put together and how you're supposed to be objective as a reporter, but I think it's more than the media. I think it's easy to say the media, but I think it's broader than that, and that's just what the point I wanted to make.
I don't think we would argue with the fact that it's broader than the media. No, media are part of a general culture. It's not just the media that are controlled by the corporate conglomerates. Now every aspect of our culture, the movies, and now the publishing industry, which used to be sort of sacrosanct. You know, you could while the media were becoming more and more monopolized, there was a period when book publishers would publish good books which were critical of society, but now the publishing houses have been taken over, and you have Disney, right, Mickey Mouse taking over big publishing houses.
I think of bookstores. I'm continuing here. Said the bookstores. Bookstores are there? Less and less and less. There's more and more Borders and Barnes & Noble, is there not? This is all an aspect of what, and that's where the battle is there.
Well, maybe the term, the problem is the term the media, that it's not broad enough for what we're talking about.
Rather different from what you said, but it touches on the same sort of topic. Right now, being faced with the situation with Iraq, but in many, many other respects, in dealing with the beliefs of many Americans who know no more than what they read in, for example, the New York Times, how would you suggest that one sort of approaches people who, given what their sources of information, the issue is narrow to, do we bomb Iraq or do we also invade? How would you suggest to begin to sort of crack through that for people who are, of good conscience and would rather not see us hurting anybody?
I think one way to approach it is with a little bit of history, because back to the media and back to the culture. The media, on whom everybody depends for information on what's going on with Iraq and what is the latest policy and so on, scrupulously avoid sort of very obvious truths. And that is that when the United States talks about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, there's an enormous hypocrisy there. Who has more weapons of mass destruction than the United States, you see? And after all, Iraq is not the only nation that has weapons. I mean, Turkey has weapons of mass destruction. Syria has weapons of mass destruction. Israel has weapons of mass destruction. Indonesia has weapons of mass destruction. China, India, Pakistan, we're not talking about them. Why? They're either our friends or our trading partners. Furthermore, who sent these weapons of mass destruction all over the world? Who sold these weapons of mass destruction to all these countries, including Iraq? You see, And I think it doesn't take more than 10 or 15 minutes of discussion and factual information and history, and also reminding people about the last Gulf War and how, what did we do? We killed 100,000 Iraqis, right? And what happened then? What did we accomplish? What was done in human terms? And what about the aftermath of that? And there's so much evidence historically about how violence unleashes more violence. And violence, even presumably in a good cause, as sometimes it's thought that violence is done, always results in that cause being contaminated by the acts of violence. I don't think it's hard. Our problem is not how to explain to people that this is morally wrong, that we are going to kill innocent people for objectives which don't make any sense. The problem is not persuading people that this is wrong. The problem is just reaching people, finding people to talk to, getting on the air, writing letters to the newspapers, speaking on community broadcast, organizing meetings and teach-ins and rallies and having candlelight vigils, the kind of things that are now being, the kind of things that movements have always done to educate people, the kind of things that were done during the Vietnam War.
A good way to end this is just to emphasize what Howard said a moment ago, absence of history. See, unless we have a knowledge of the past, of how things came to be, how did this guy come to be in Iraq to begin with? Absence of history. We have 30-second sound bites. And so what happened today is forgotten tomorrow. And so the young have no sense of history. It's no fault of their own. We are suffering at the moment from a national Alzheimer's disease. At this moment, it is so. And it's for us to be doctors, in a sense. For us to be physicians, in a sense, healing ourselves as well as others. And it's by teachers such a sense of past, how did something come to be? And that's what it's all about. And that's what I hope we're all about. And I think this is a way of saying thank you very much.
Okay. Great job. That's it.
Can we get it, Jim? We did it. We got this. And so here we are. Thank you. Take a bow. Hey, we'll do it. No, turn around. Turn around. This the way they do it, you know. Now we take a bow.